is the Stargirl After Show with Sarah and Sean. Your post-show breakdown of DC Stargirl with Easter eggs, exclusive behind-the-scenes info, and cast and crew interviews.
This is our destiny.
I finally know who I really am.
I'm Stargirl.
This is the Stargirl After Show.
Hey, Stargirl fans. The season of Stargirl is over, but we continue on. Welcome back to Stargirl After Show, sponsored as always by Stargirl.tv and DCTV.news, your best resources for news, media, and spoilers about Stargirl and other DC Comics properties. I'm Sean.
And I'm Sarah.
And this week we're going to bring you an extended edition of our interview with Neil Jackson, Mr. Icicle himself.
Yeah, this is great because you get his opinions on the entire season, not just up through episode 3, which is when we aired his first interview. And you get to hear all about how he fought James Bond, and that's really cool.
Yeah, that was the great thing about being a crew member interviewing the cast, is that they knew that they could talk with me about stuff that they couldn't talk with most other people. Because they knew that I was dedicated to and legally obligated to cut out any spoilers. So I made two versions of every one of our interviews. One with spoilers, one without. And now that the season's over, I can give you all the spoiler ones. And we're really excited to do that. Most of these are over an hour long. Or about an hour long.
Yeah, and totally worth it.
My favorite one is the LJ Shannon interview. That's an hour and a half long, that interview. That's the longest of all of them because she's very chatty and passionate about what she does.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear her full one.
Now, before we get into the interview and everything, I just want to say thank you to all our listeners. This podcast has been a lot of fun to make, and interacting with all of you has been really fantastic. I love how committed you all are to the show, how engaged you are with, when I say the show, I mean Stargirl, but also with the podcast.
Yeah, it's great that all of you guys are just as passionate about the show as we are too.
And if I can say, it's been really humbling to me that our podcast is cited quite often on social media as an authority. You know, if someone's saying, oh, CW is going to ruin season 2, I see a lot of people respond with, oh no, Stargirl Pod said it won't. So you can take that to the bank. And it just makes me feel real good.
Yeah. I was just going to say, in between seasons, we aren't sure when season 2 is going to start back up, but we're not going anywhere. We're going to have the extended interviews of everyone you've heard so far. And then we also have quite a few people lined up to interview in the break. And so you'll get more information coming at you.
Yeah, with only 13 episodes during the season and such a large cast, we couldn't get to everybody during the main season, but everyone was so amazing that I want to talk to everybody. And luckily, a lot of people are willing to talk to us. So we're going to bring you those. And hopefully we can keep posting at least once every other week between now and season 2 premiering without it being, you know, while still giving you new stuff and without it being too repetitive and boring.
Yeah. And if there's anything you guys want to hear, anyone you want to hear from, cast or crew, please reach out to us on our socials and we will see what we can do.
Those socials, by the way, are at Stargirl Pod. Pretty much anywhere you can look at Stargirl Pod is going to be us. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. We're on all three.
Yep.
So I did have a lot of fun talking to Neil. He was the first interview I've ever conducted. And he was super lovely about it. And he's had a great career even before being Icicle. And he was very forthcoming about everything and just loved to share his experience. So I loved to hear it.
Yeah, it was such a fun listen. He is so passionate about people who are passionate. It just, I found it very infectious and inspiring as I was listening to it.
It's true. He's an amazing man. So without further ado, we are going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back with our extended hour-long interview with Neil Jackson.
Stargirl After Show. Stargirl After Show.
Neil, thank you for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Sean. How are you, mate?
I'm excellent. Thank you so much. So I guess we'll just jump right in. I wanted to ask you, in terms of comic book lore, were you a fan before getting into this at all?
I'm a fan of comic books, and it's an interesting thing with British people, as you can tell by my accent. Comic books weren't a massive thing when I was growing up. Comic books tended to be more of an American thing. There weren't comic book stores when I was a kid. In Britain, comic books tended to be the sort of Sunday supplements that came with the big newspapers. But they weren't the Batman, Superman, DC, Marvel type stuff. I was aware of them, and my sort of biggest introduction to comic books was the X-Men cartoon. When the X-Men cartoon came out, I was a huge, huge fan of that. And you were able to get sort of comic book almanacs of multiple issues and a hardback cover. So I remember reading a few Thor when I was a kid. But I loved comic books, but just wasn't a voracious reader of them because it wasn't part of our culture. I knew of Stargirl because I've been friends with Geoff Johns for 15 years. We worked together on a TV series adaptation of Blade that was called Blade the Series that we shot 15 years ago in Vancouver. Met Geoff for the first time on that one. He was one of the writers on it, and we became friends. So I knew of Stargirl, and I knew that Stargirl was obviously a hugely personal pet project for him for all the reasons that everybody who's a fan of the show will know. But I'd never read any of the comics. And honestly, when I looked at a couple of the comics, they always seemed like they skewed a little younger than my taste would go. It was always very sort of smash pop, bright colors kind of stuff. So I didn't know a great deal about it. And it was January last year, so 2019, I got a call from Geoff. And he said, I'm not sure if you're aware, but we're putting together a live action TV version of Stargirl, and I'd love you to be a part of it to play Jordan McKent. And hugely flattered, because obviously to be offered a role anyway as an actor is hugely flattering. But to be offered a role by Geoff, who's a friend of mine, to be a part of his prep project, I knew that it was a huge honor to be something a part of. And he started telling me about the character. He said, let me just give you a little bit of a breakdown. He said he's called Jordan McKent. He's a businessman, but he's also this incredibly powerful supervillain, part of the Injustice Society, which flagged me for a second. I'm like, they're called the Injustice Society, which is so fun in the show when Courtney calls reference to some of these names. I was like, oh good, they're mentioning it, kind of like in the Shazam way of doing stuff, that they're politely mocking the way that it's a little tongue-in-cheek. And then he said, yeah, Jordan has the ability to turn himself into ice, and he's this character called Icicle. And again, I kind of chuckled to myself. I was like, Icicle doesn't sound like the most threatening of names. He sounds more like a sort of My Little Pony character than he does this vicious villain that's going to inflict dread in the hearts of his enemies.
Now, did you happen to Google any pictures of Icicle and maybe get a little worried?
I did, yeah. I mean, this is the thing. Geoff pitched it all to me over the phone, and he said, let me give you a full breakdown of what we want to do with it. And once he started getting into the character, of course I knew it was going to be brilliant in Britain because it's Geoff, and Geoff is a genius. But when he started telling me about the backstory of Icicle, about the fact that he had fallen in love with this wonderful woman and then had a child, and then she had ended up getting cancer, and she ends up dying from cancer, and it's not her fault, and it was all brought on by this nefarious company who were doing this ill-gotten stuff. And as a result of that one Nexus moment, then Jordan made it his mission in life to make sure nobody would ever have to suffer this injustice again. I suddenly went, this guy's not a villain. This guy's a hero. There's everything about his motivations is understandable and justifiable. And I think very few people, just from the description that I just said, will find fault in what he's trying to do. He's ultimately trying to make the world a better place and make sure that people never have to have what happened to his wife. It just so happens the methods that he goes about it aren't exactly the way that most people would condone. But the moment I understood his motivations for everything, I fell in love with this character and just went, he's not a villain. I know how to play him. He's a man who is being incredibly stricken by grief and anger and is trying to get redemption for what happened to his wife. But moreover, he's trying to make sure that the world he leaves his son, their son, is better than the one they're currently in. And that excited me. But then I Googled Icicle on the internet and started seeing these sort of Jack Frost, Rumpelstiltskin imps.
Yeah, he looks like a Rankin Bass character.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, oh, okay, that doesn't seem to fit in with the description that Jeff just gave me. And then I was back in Britain at the time, and I was shooting the Kingsman movie. And we were chatting back and forth about costume design and the initial look. They sent me this great artist rendering of Icicle, that the way the head would look, and they'd done it using my head as a model. And it's very, very similar to the way he ends up in the final version that I've just seen in the extended trailer. But the costume, they said they sent through some costume designs, and they wanted to do an homage to the stuff in the comic books, where he's ranges from being dressed as this sort of silver-clad imp to these white outfits, all really leaning into the frost and the ice metaphor. And what they sent through was a form-fitting sort of lycra snakeskin silver tracksuit was going to be the initial Icicle look. And I was like, I couldn't wrap my head around it. I couldn't wrap my head around the idea from the breakdown, the description that he'd given me, the idea that there's this high power businessman in these wonderful bespoke suits and he dresses really expensively. And then he goes down to his lair to start doing his real plan as part of the Injustice Society. And the costume that he chooses to put on looks like he should be at a sort of German discotheque in the 80s. It didn't seem to make sense to me. So I started talking to him. I said, the way I see it and the way that you were talking about it was he sounds like a guy who's on a mission. So what if we lent into the military aspect of it and made him more combative? He's putting on an outfit because he's ready to get his hands dirty. He's taking off his $1,000 suit and he's putting on a practical outfit that allows him to physically fight for the things that he wants, that he can't do as Jordan. And so we bounced back ideas. I managed to find an original panel from one of the comics that had Icicle in combat gear. He had a bulletproof vest on and looked very much like a SWAT soldier. And we liked that, and they took shades of that and ended up working with the costume designer and Jeff, and they came up with the look for Icicle, which thankfully is more in line with the description that Jeff initially gave me of a guy who's grief-stricken and is trying to enact this mission to save the world.
Yeah, a cartoonish outfit doesn't really convey that, does it?
Not really. I mean, it was this thing of just... And they've done it brilliantly with the series, both in dialogue and the way that they kind of play with it, is acknowledging that some of the elements of the Stargirl universe and the Justice Injustice Society are a little kitsch. I mean, for the fact that the main villain is called Icicle. Icicle isn't a name that enacts a great deal of dread, in the same way that Justice Society and Injustice Society is very kitsch. But they acknowledge that in a very... respectful and intelligent way. And I wanted to make sure that with my character, at least, we leaned away from the kitsch, because the kitsch is already inherent in it. It's a superhero character, so it can easily lean into the kitsch. So trying to ground that as much as possible through the character's emotions made the most sense. And thankfully, we ended up with an outfit for Icicle that is amazing. And incredibly hot, actually. We didn't think about that. We were shooting in Atlanta in the summer, and I end up wearing a cashmere sweater with a thick overcoat. So a man made of ice was actually in reality just sweating buckets underneath that.
Well, that's the curse of pretty much any superhero film, isn't it?
Yeah.
When they shoot in Atlanta, and a lot do.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the cheesiness of the name, the Injustice Society, and Jordan has a line when he's talking to William Zarek on the porch that he's fighting injustice, which you also mentioned. And I think that that's a really brilliant way, because when you see something like Injustice Society or the Crime Syndicate or any of these other names, it's really hard to give an organization with that name an altruistic purpose.
Yes.
But Jeff found a way.
That's the brilliance of Jeff. It's taking what was existing within these characters, within this world, and modernizing it in a way that makes it palpable to modern audiences. And that's exactly what you said there about Jordan saying he's fighting injustice. That was the hook that made me excited to be a part of this show and excited to play Jordan / Icicle, is the fact that he's not a villain. This terrible, heinous injustice happened to him and to his wife and their family. And he just so happens to have the power and the mental acuity to fight this injustice and make sure that nobody else has to suffer from it going forward. And that as a character trait is fascinating, because the thing that I love most about that is, yeah, COD villains are great and they have a place. The sort of Mike Myers of the world have a great place as canons in movies and lore. But the ones that are more nuanced and layered are the ones that are far more interesting for me to watch and also far more interesting for me to play. And what I love about the third episode, the Icicle episode, is we get this glimpse into the backstory and motivations behind Jordan and what led him to become the man that we see all those years later. And I'm really hoping that it's going to create conflict within the audience, because, of course, everyone's going to want to choose a side, and surely they're going to choose the side of the Justice Society with Stargirl, and that's going to be pitted against the Injustice Society and Icicle. So they're going to be looking to Icicle as being this villain. But what episode 3 does so brilliantly is it turns that on its head by giving plausible motivations behind Jordan's actions and making sure that we understand that he's not just doing this for this mustache twirling nefarious reasons, but he's actually motivated by something that's pure and completely understandable, and that most people on the planet would have the same feelings if something happened to one of their loved ones. They would want to get revenge. They would want to make sure this doesn't happen. It's going to cause this conflict in the audiences that once a skerrick of empathy comes in for Icicle, which will happen in episode 3, it can't not happen. Suddenly we have a really interesting, dramatic dynamic that we get to play off for the rest of the season, that audiences are going to watch Courtney and want to support her, but some part of them is going to want to support Icicle because they understand and they believe in what he's doing. And if we can achieve that, we've got something that's really fascinating for audiences to tune in and every single week.
And what's really interesting is when the full plan is revealed much later in the season, even members of the Justice Society are going, wait a second, are we sure we want to stop these guys?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, who wouldn't want to enact a plan that makes sure that everybody is happier, friendlier, more conscientious, better to each other, basically kind of returning to those Norman Rockwell ideals of a bygone age? And if you can prevent the things that happen to Christine and to Jordan from happening to anybody else, why wouldn't you want to make that happen? Now, of course, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs, and there's a few eggs that are going to be broken in the course of this. But as long as they're not your own eggs, is that such a bad thing?
As a bullet-pointed list, it's a good set of goals.
Yeah.
It's just the asterisk you have to watch out for. That footnote is a killer.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things me and Jeff talked about a lot was the sort of using Thanos as a touchstone for this. And because Thanos is such a great villain in the Marvel Universe, because exactly the same as Jordan is, he is looking at the big picture. He's a macro thinker, and he's looking at the big picture to make and realizing that there's a problem. There's an inherent problem that means that ultimately life, or from Jordan's perspective, humanity is suffering. And how do you make sure that humanity doesn't suffer? There has to be a seismic change in the paradigm by which we're living our lives, and he has a way to enact that change. There's going to be some collateral damage, which means a few people will suffer and a few people will die. But out of that change will ultimately flourish a better society and a better world in which people can live. So really, in his own mind, he's a hero. He's a humanist, and he is doing the thing that is necessary that nobody else has the strength to make happen. So he is 100% convinced and vitriolic in his quest that he is doing the right thing. And when you've got somebody who's like that, they're incredibly charismatic and can draw people to their cause. But they also, in the case of Jordan, he also, being so unwavering, anything that comes into conflict with that plan, it has to be destroyed.
Yeah, and I think it's important for any villain, really, to have that. There's not been a compelling villain, probably in the history of storytelling, that thought of themselves as the bad guy.
No. I mean, look, you go back through movie history and through literature history, the best villains are the ones who believe that they're justified. I mean, look, even Hitler thought that he was right in his own way. And I don't think there's anybody who's sitting there twiddling their mustache going, I'm going to do evil today. I don't think there's a person on the planet. They may be mentally misguided or impaired, but in their own mind, they're justified that their actions are the absolute right actions. And tapping into that in a way that makes other people start to see their perspective and maybe not root for them, but understand them is a really powerful thing that we've managed to do and what Jeff has managed to do with Stargirl. Because as the kids say when they hear the plan, it's a good plan. I mean, the ultimate end of that plan seems like it's the sort of thing that everybody would want, right? It just so happens, as you said, the asterisk is a pretty big asterisk.
So we're talking about all the motivations of Jordan, who is a well-intentioned bad guy, let's say. In general, in your career, and I want to go back and talk a bit about your broader career, but do you prefer playing bad roles or protagonistic roles?
I like playing good roles. I like playing characters who have a lot of internal conflict in them. And they can be heroes, they can be anti-heroes, they can be antagonist, protagonist, as long as they seem three-dimensional to me, because we all have that. I mean, it's like you can be the most saintly person in the world, but at the right day or the wrong day, and the right or wrong moment, somebody cuts you up in traffic, you can find yourself uttering some things that you wouldn't want the rest of the world to hear. We all have these shades to us. Nobody is 100% good. And that's why, in my opinion, the most boring character in fictional history is Superman, because he's so good and he's so powerful that the reason he's fascinating to me is because of the Lex Luthors of the world and the people that come up against him, because they have these layers. They have this sort of interesting dynamics that makes us human. So I gravitate towards three-dimensional characters. It just so happens most of them happen to be on the, in quotations, villainous scale. And also, villains are unencumbered. Heroes, whether they're anti-heroes or not, they tend to have to live by some level of a code so that the audiences ultimately root for them. Whereas the villain doesn't. He can really say and do whatever he wants or whatever is necessary to get his goal attained. And that's way more interesting to me.
That's an excellent point. So Now, to talk about your wider career, I was a little astonished, honestly. It looks like your first role was in about 2002 in film and television, and you've had 60 credits since then.
Wow.
That is not a long time to amass 60 credits, Neil Jackson.
I don't know, that many. Yeah, honestly, I pinch myself with my career. I mean, I was born in Luton, which is 20 miles north of London. It's a town that is wonderful and also a little rough. It's a working class town. I kind of liken it to Americans, to a sort of Detroit. It's very much that kind of a town built on the car industry with very blue collar workers. I loved it there. Not a single soul that I knew or knew about was in the film or television industry. I didn't even know that there was an entertainment industry. I just thought that TV and film was made somewhere else in some magical kingdom. And so it never even entered my sphere. And I'm still that 10-year-old boy from Luton who would beg his dad to go and take him to the cinema so he can go and see Superman or Herbie Goes Bananas or whatever was on at the cinema at the time. I loved being in that world, and I loved the magic of watching these stories being told on this big picture. And so the idea that I get to be on these sets like Stargirl, like Kingsman, like the Bond franchise just boggles me. And there's honestly not a day that goes by when I'm on set that I don't have a little internal giggle and just like, meh. You know, it's almost like I've heard actors saying they're waiting to be found out. They keep waiting for somebody to be like, oh, what are you doing here? No, you're not supposed to be. There was a mistake. I don't feel that. I don't feel like somebody's going to kick me out. I just feel like somebody's given me the keys and I can't believe that they let me do this, because I never in my childhood even understood that such a thing was possible. And then to stand on a set like Stargirl with the huge robot that had been built, the practical stripe that had been built, and these amazing costumes and wonderful collaborators like Jeff Johns and all the directors that we had on, and yourself doing the incredible work that you did, Sean, it's just is a dream come true for me. And I pinch myself every single day.
So I have a guess as to what it probably would be, at least for me. But what was the biggest, like, I can't believe I'm here doing this right now moment for you in your career as a whole?
In my career? There's several of them. I mean, the one I think you're probably going to say is when I got to have a fight with James Bond.
Exactly. That's the one.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, being a boy, James Bond was a huge icon for me. Being a British boy, James Bond was the icon for me. And I grew up in the Roger Moore era of James Bond in the 80s and then transitioned into all of the Bonds that came since. And from the moment I was able to go to the cinema, I was going to the cinema to watch the James Bond movies whenever they came out. They were always the big spectacle. I loved them. I loved him. I loved how cool he was and suave he was. And so, honestly, I would have paid to be a walk-on extra in the back of a Bond scene. So when this audition came in to play this character, Mr. Slate, I jumped at the chance, as did every single male actor within the range. And I went and met the casting director and I auditioned, never really thinking it would become of anything. And then I got told I got through that audition phase and there was going to be a stunt audition. And I was like, okay, I've never before and never since done a stunt audition. I think stunt auditions are a great thing that more people should do, because obviously if you're going to be involved in these fight sequences, you want to know that the person that's going to be involved in it, who's working with the lead actor, who you're fairly invested in, can actually move and do the job that they're supposed to do. So we went to Pinewood, onto the 007 stage, and there was me and 16 other actors who have been shortlisted to play this role. And it was like Stunt Idol. There was a panel of judges behind a table, which was the casting director, associate producer, stunt coordinator, fight choreographer, all these people. And they came out and they gave us a talk, and then they broke us into groups of four. So four groups of four. And they said, they taught us a 3-on-1 fight sequence. So three guys attacking one guy. And they taught us that sequence. We went away, we rehearsed it, we came back, we performed it in front of the panel of judges. And then the 16 of us went to another room going, I don't know what's going on. And then they called 12 of us back. And we were like, oh, we're getting eliminated. So they'd eliminated four of us. We came back. They taught us a two-on-one fight sequence in groups. We performed that. We went back. We came back. Now there's only 10 of us. And over the course of 2.5 hours, they really put us through our paces, doing various different fight sequences, rolling drills. And thankfully, my background is in fighting. I did martial arts for a long time as a kid. I was an amateur boxer for years and won a couple of national titles. And so I was always very physical and loved that stuff. Another advantage I had was that the stunt coordinator, I'd worked with him on his first big feature, which was Alexander, the Oliver Stone film. And so knew him and some of the other stunt guys. They finally whittled us down to three people, and they said, we're going to send the three suggestions over to Mark Forster and the Broccolis to make a decision. And I was so lucky that I was the one that was selected. So to get to stand on set with James Bond, throwing punches and going blow for blow for him, was that moment that made the eight-year-old in me just do backflips.
It's almost enough that you don't so much care what that character's motivation is. You just get to fight James Bond.
Yeah, that one wasn't even, it wasn't even a deep dive. I mean, I initially had, like I said, we did an acting audition. So there was initially a lot more to that character than what ended up on screen. He ended up with this fight sequence that I'm still wildly happy about. People still talk about that brutal fight sequence. It was very, very practical, very, very brutal. We rehearsed, we shot in Panama, which was amazing. And I was in Panama for 2.5 weeks. And I mean, it was a dream gig. Daniel Craig was shooting all day, 5 days a week. And then every evening, he'd get back from shooting, and me, him, the fight choreographer, and our stunt doubles would meet up, and we would rehearse for anywhere from a half an hour to an hour on the fight sequence, rehearsing it. And then next day he would go back to work, which meant I just sat around the pool all day drinking Mai Tais, just hanging out. And in the evening I got to have a little bit of a scrap with Bond, and we rehearsed for 2 weeks, and then we went to the set and we shot it over the course of 2 days.
That's amazing.
Yeah, getting to hang out with Daniel, and yeah, like, I mean, we beat the snot out of each other. There's a bit in it where he hits me in the head with a computer, and they had a computer casing without the hard drive in it, but still a hard plastic computer casing that he's supposed to swipe at my head, and I kind of duck out of the way. But take one, he smacks me on the head. Take two, he smacks me on the head. There's a moment where he picks up a shoe and punches me in the throat. Take one, he hits me in the throat. And it's just one of those things. You're in the middle of this frenetic fight sequence. And they always talk about stunt performers when you're working on a scene. You're talking percentages. So let's rehearse this at 30% or 40%. And you normally talk about the film speed that you go for is about 80%. And that's with full knowledge that there's something happens when they call action. The moment you call action, 80% becomes 110%. Your adrenaline gets going, the camera's going, and suddenly you're in it. And accidents happen. And I remember that the first night after filming, that first day, we were sat in the bar, me, Daniel, and our stunt doubles and a few other people. He's got bruises all up his forearm from blocking the punches. My throat is sore. I had a bruise on the side of my head from hitting me with the computer, and we're drinking a whiskey. And it was, I couldn't have been happier. You know, it was just, I'm doing this job that I've dreamed of doing my entire life. And I'm on set with James Bond in a James Bond movie. It was a dream come true.
I can definitely imagine that. You've had quite the career, and not just as an actor. You're also a screenwriter. You've directed some. And like you mentioned, you took, what, two titles, boxing in Wales?
Yeah, I boxing as an amateur, we... there's a thing called the British University... British University Championships. And so all the universities in Britain get together and compete in various different sports, like a mini sort of Commonwealth Games or Olympics. And this goes on throughout the year. And I entered into the British University Championships the first year I'd started boxing. I've been doing martial arts, but I'd only been boxing for about 3 months, and went in. And by some weird miracle, I ended up winning the championships at light middleweight. and then went back 2 years later and won it in middleweight. So, and then was boxing as an amateur and was second in Wales. And I ended up having a really nice career before transitioning and pretending to be people.
And you're also a musician?
Yeah, I just... I
listened to some of your songs on your website, and I'm into them. They're good.
Oh, nice. Thank you, mate. I tell you what it is. I think that no artist is just a single artist. There's not very few people operate in one medium and one medium only. I find that a lot of writers like to paint. I find that a lot of musicians like to write. I find that people tend to cross-pollinate between various different mediums, especially now more than ever, where it's more and more palpable. Actually, quite a few people that are in the cast of Stargirl are multi-hyphenates. You've got Jake. He's an amazing musician, brilliant guitarist, got an incredible voice. He's got songs that have been released. Same with Meg DeLacy. She's an incredible singer and songwriter. Chris Baker, who I actually lived with while we were shooting Stargirl, who plays Brainwave, is an incredible blues guitarist. We used to sit of the evening just having a gin and tonic, and he'd be playing these amazing blues riffs. I think that quite a few people dabble in various different platforms, and it's always been this thing for me that I want to sate my creativity in whatever way that is, and the music was a big thing for me for a while, but once I recorded the album, then recorded an EP, in order for me to pursue music, at least at that point, with more ardor, would have meant me sacrificing my acting career, because I would have had to go on tour, I would have had to turn down jobs, and it was just at the point that my acting career was really starting to move, so I made the decision to focus on my acting career, which I don't regret at all, but the guitar always travels with me.
Well, that's excellent. I mean, I guess I can relate. You know, I've got my graphics work. I've got all my podcasts. I'm a less accomplished multi-hyphenate.
I don't think I do. It's not really about accomplishment. It's really about just pursuing a thing that makes you passionate. And if one thing and one thing solely is the thing that makes you passionate, then great, pursue that one thing. But we live in a world where diversity is more than ever possible and applauded. And if you like this podcast for you, I mean, you're an amazing graphic artist and very much respected throughout the industry. And then you've got these other passions that keep you going. And if you can juggle them all at once, then more power to you.
So getting back to your acting career, I have a question for you. Maybe you won't like it. I don't know. But why is it, Neil, that you are the only British person who has not appeared in a Harry Potter movie or on Doctor Who?
Because there's a conspiracy against me. I don't know, mate. I honestly don't know. I mean, Harry Potter was, as I was starting my career, Harry Potter was kind of into episode 5, I guess. And I'd already moved to the States. So Harry Potter, maybe if I'd have stayed in Britain, then maybe I may have got auditions and Harry Potter might have been something. And the same with Doctor Who, the resurgence of Doctor Who happened once I was already living in the States. And I actually got offered an episode of Doctor Who maybe 4 years ago, but it clashed with a project that I was already shooting. It would have been great fun to go into Doctor Who and do something like that. I think it's just one of those things of, I have been living in North America now for 15 years, and a lot of those shows are local casting and happening locally. And also, as you said, and hearing you say it is astounding to me, with 60 credits over the course of 18 years, I've been very busy, and there's a lot of stuff I've missed out on because of other work that I've been doing.
That was actually what made me ask you that, because you don't see many Brits with such a prolific resume that haven't been on one of those two properties. But if you've been living in the States for that long, in North America for that long, then that definitely makes sense.
Yeah. And I would never change anything. It's like, I've had these conversations with my acting teacher, who I love to death back in Britain, Michael Armstrong, who's my mentor. And, 3.5 years into my acting career, I made the decision to move to the States, and I was just getting established in the UK, and I'd done a couple of films, one big one being Alexander, the Oliver Stone film. And when I knew that the premiere was going to be happening in LA, I came over to LA for the premiere and ended up staying for 5 days just to see what LA was like. And in those 5 days, I got more auditions than I probably had in 6 months in the UK. There's just way more content at that time. And so I thought I'll give it a go and come over and chance my arm. And I didn't work for the first 8 months of being here, but got sniffs at things, and it made me realize that there's a lot more potential for me over in the States. And the first job I actually booked in the States was Stargate, SG-1, and I got to play an amazing character called Kalik on that, which was a one-off standalone episode, but that became a real fan favorite. And I've talked about it. I was like, who knows what my career would have been if I stayed in Britain, but you just can't think like that. At the time when I was in Britain, the sort of contemporaries I was auditioning against, Michael Fassbender and various people like this, and they've had the careers that they've had, and I wouldn't change a second of my career. I feel very honored to have done and been involved in the projects that I've been with, working with the people I've got to work with. I mean, like Robert Zemeckis, 2.5 years ago, I got to do a Robert Zemeckis movie, and 10-year-old me, when I was 10, that was when Who Framed Roger Rabbit came out. And I saw that in the movie, in the cinema 3 times. And I remember begging my parents to take me to the cinema, and bless them, they came along and they sat with me 2 extra times past having seen it already. And I bought the book of it, the production book, and I had a Who Framed Roger Rabbit cuddly doll that I would carry around with me in a very rough neighborhood in Luton, almost challenging anybody to say anything, because I was so enamored by this world that he created. It transported me and blew my 10-year-old mind open. So to get to stand on set with Robert Zemeckis and him calling action on scenes that I'd done, and now in my office to have an original poster from Who Framed Roger Rabbit with Robert Zemeckis having written Welcome to Toontown on it, it astounds me.
That's amazing. And something I can very much relate to, because that is one of my all-time favorite films. My best friend and I used to literally just walk around reciting the entire movie from memory.
It's so good. That was my terrible Who Framed Roger Rabbit impersonation.
It's better than mine, which is also terrible. I've had a lot of practice at doing that terribly, because on my other podcast, Table Reads, we read scripts for movies that never got made.
Okay.
And one of them we did was Roger Rabbit Toon Platoon, written by Nat Mulder. And the whole premise of my podcast is they're mostly really bad, and we do a lot of mockery.
Right.
That was the first script that we read on the podcast that was astonishingly good. And it was written right after Roger Rabbit came out, and I don't know why it didn't get made into a movie.
Doesn't it just break your heart when you see stuff like that? I mean, that's one of the big takeaways that I've got from 20 years now of doing this, is that nobody knows. I mean, it's that William Goldman thing, right? Nobody knows anything. And anybody who says they know anything is either a liar or delusional. Because I've read some incredible projects. I'm just like, God, this is a slam dunk. And then it's ended up either not being made, or it's been made and not been particularly good. And I've read some stuff that's just like, oh, this doesn't come off the page. And when it's finally been made, I'm like, this is incredible. And the amount of work that goes into every iteration of this industry, I mean, you know yourself from the graphic design world, the amount of time that you would spend working on something that might not even make the shot, might not even make the edit, but the amount of hours that you've spent sweating on that. And that's the most humbling thing that I find with this industry, is that every single person involved in it works so hard to make sure that what is on screen is the best it can possibly be. And that even means sometimes the work that they're doing never makes it.
You know, there's a really good example of that in the Icicle episode.
Yeah.
You know, Pat takes Courtney to the JSA headquarters.
Okay.
And knowing that was coming up, I did a logo for the JSA, like a seal with the eagle and everything and the shield, and spent probably a couple weeks of iterations on it, like dozens of iterations. And it made it to set, but it is not in the episode.
But that's, this is the stuff that, I mean, it comes back to passion, right? I mean, I've talked multiple times about passion to me is everything. And I would much rather talk to a passionate bricklayer than an apathetic astronaut. You know, if somebody is passionate about something, that's infectious and it's fascinating. And to do what we do, to do what you do, you need passion. You need passion to spend, as you said, a couple of weeks designing, redesigning, working on something in the hope that it makes the cut. And if it doesn't, that's okay. That's part of the process. And then you throw that passion to the next thing. And that's the stuff that obviously builds careers. But moreover, that's the stuff that makes the collaborative process of film and television making so exciting to me, because when it works, and it worked on Stargirl, everybody is carrying that passion into everything. I mean, the DPs, the gaffers, the lighting people, everybody. I mean, even the catering was phenomenal. Everybody is invested in this project, trying to do everything they can to make it the best it can be. And when it works and it clicks like that, like on a show like Stargirl, it transcends. And I'm so excited to see that on screen.
It has been really amazing to watch thus far. The show's coming together so well. It's cinematic, really. Visually speaking, you know, it's being put on the CW after it's on the DC Universe app. And as much as I love the CW shows, none of them hold a candle in terms of style or visuals to Stargirl. It's just beyond the pale.
That's great to hear. That's really great to hear. And everything starts from the top, right? It trickles down. And we happen to have the best in the business in Geoff Johns standing in the number one position. He is leading the charge. And his passion, his enthusiasm, and also he's an incredibly gracious collaborator. It's one of the things that I've always loved about him is that he's very quick to say no, and he's also very quick to say yes. He has a very clear, singular vision about what he wants, but if something improves upon that, he's very quick to jump on that and bring that in. He wants everybody's input. And that was proven to me from the get-go with this, which I knew it would because I've known Geoff for a long while, but to collaborate with him on the costume so closely and come to something that we all agreed was the perfect iteration of what this character was. And then also the look of Jordan. It turned out we were semi hamstrung in a very good way because I was shooting this World War One, the Kingsman movie. And so they were in first position. So they'd hired me first, which means they'd locked the look for my character for that. Which
so
means
you had to have that short cropped hair.
Yeah, we couldn't cut my hair, but that hairstyle actually worked. And what we decided to do was, I'm blonde anyway, but what they wanted to do was to give the nod to Icicle and also to the Nordic roots from where Jordan came from, is really play up the blondness. And so we ended up putting a dye in my hair and really pulling out the blonde highlights, which worked perfectly because the only stuff I had left to shoot, we had to liaise very closely with the Kingsman, was me wearing a World War One helmet. All the stuff with me without the helmet had already been shot, which meant that we couldn't change the hairstyle in case they needed to do a reshoot, but we could doctor the hair because it was going to be hidden by this hat. And turning him so incredibly blonde just worked for the character, because not only does it give the doffed cap to the Icicle nature, but it makes him seem slightly more statuesque. You know, it's a very dark show, as you've seen, and as your audience would know by now, having watched a few of it, in terms of tone, the color saturation. We shot it, the way they lit it was very dark and ominous and shadowy. And so to have Jordan being this very, very blonde, and I'm very pale and borderline albino character in there kind of just made him pop a little more within the color palette, which was a brilliant idea. And that was Jeff's suggestion and the hair and makeup crew.
And again, the hair and makeup, the costumes, everybody was really on point for this whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, a real treat for me, there were multiple treats for me when we were shooting Stargirl, but one of the real treats for me was Nelson Lee has been a dear friend of mine ever since we worked together on Blade, which is where we both met Jeff. And he plays Dragon King in this. And I'd already shot the first couple of episodes, and when Dragon King is introduced, I'm not sure where it is in episode 3 or 4, the very first scene that Nelson had on Stargirl was in the Injustice Society lair with just me. And we came in, we did a quick audition, a quick rehearsal, and then they cleared the set and Jeff walked in and I teared up. We had this little moment of, I haven't been on set with Nelson, even though we're very, very close friends for 15 years. Haven't been on set with Jeff, even though we know each other very well for 15 years. And here the three of us having this reunion, playing these amazing characters on this show that Jeff was had created, was a really emotional moment. We all had a little hug and an acknowledgement to this. And that was a real gift for me.
It's really great. I don't really have anything on that level that I experienced, but I was there when Jeff saw Stripe fully assembled for the first time.
Wow.
And just seeing, like, he was just staring at it with like this smile on his face. And
can
I was
you
like,
imagine, I mean, I can't imagine what that's like. And one day I hope to get to imagine what, see what that's like, but to have an idea in your head that then you put down on paper, then you get inked into a comic book 25 years ago with the first iteration. And then 25 years later to see a character you created fully actualized in a physical form has got to just be breathtaking.
Yeah. I asked him, I said, did you ever think back in, you know, 1999 that you would be standing and looking at this? And he's like, no, no.
Yeah.
And that's the magic of the show in general, I think, is Jeff's passion for it kind of goes, it trickles down. That's the real trickle down economy, is Jeff's passion at the top of the Stargirl pyramid or whatever, trickling down to everybody and infecting us all.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Now I have I wanted to come up with one question that I would ask everybody. Just because I thought it was kind of fun.
Okay.
And that is, if you couldn't have played Icicle on this show, what other role would you have been interested in? Like, what other role do you wish you could have played if not Icicle?
That's a really good question. The other role I think I would want to play is actually Pat. I think that role is fascinating to me. I mean, for all the conflict reasons that we've talked about before, and Luke Wilson plays it just so perfectly. He is a man who is very righteous and honorable, who has seen his friend die in his arms. He's resigned to the fact he's always going to be the sidekick, but he's the person that's got everybody's back, and he's always looking at the big picture to try to make sure that everybody is safe. He's an incredibly noble and honorable character. But within there, he's kind of harboring this secret as well. He's been harboring the secret for a long while from his wife, played by Amy Smart, and from his step daughter, and from his son. And he has this incredible arc in it, even though he is, in quotations, a sidekick. He's every part the hero that I think Stargirl is, because he's the guy that brings everybody together. He's the glue that binds the Justice Society. And he's also a lot of fun. I mean, I can't wait. There's one scene I can't wait to see that was with he goes into Dragon King's house and he sees Dragon King's wife, who is this very starved for company, very highly strung woman, and she ends up hitting on him. And on the page, and when we did the table read, we were all in guffaws of laughter, just watching Luke do what Luke does brilliantly, which is this understated, relatable, comedic brilliance. And I can't wait to see that scene.
The other thing that I find really interesting about Pat as a character is, despite clearly exhibiting all these heroic traits, he also is very, very unsure of himself.
Yeah.
He has almost no self-confidence.
I mean, it's completely human. I mean, how many people have we all met who are in their own right from the outset brilliant, but when you tell them that you think they're brilliant, it's a shock to them. I mean, that humility is what makes us human, but it's also an incredibly attractive trait. Because it's very difficult to accept. You just go about doing it. I mean, he's a man driven by his circumstances. He is inherently heroic, but because of the circumstances presented to himself, he finds a way to step up and be of service to make sure that he can help the situation improve. And I think that's so fascinating. He is a reluctant hero.
Yeah, when he sets off to confront Icicle, he thinks that he's going to make the ultimate sacrifice.
Yeah.
He says, if I'm not back by morning, you get your family out of here.
Mm-hmm.
That might actually be when he heads off against Brainwave. Now I'm getting confused.
Regardless, he as you said, he's ready to make the ultimate sacrifice to protect the people that he loves. He's a great character. He would have been a really fun one to play. I'm very glad I didn't have to play it because Luke plays it better than I ever possibly could. He's so good on screen. And the precious few scenes that we had together, a real joy for me was the dinner table scene where we're all sat around having dinner, where Icicle comes to dinner with Courtney at that moment, not knowing that he's Icicle, and the audience obviously knowing, but she knows that there is an Icicle that's this threat. And in the middle of the scene, she realizes, and suddenly she's aware that she sat having dinner with her nemesis, and Icicle doesn't know that she's Stargirl. It's just a brilliantly written scene full of all this amazing conflict, but also loads of humor done in the way that only Jeff can do so brilliantly. That was a lot of fun to play. And also within there was a Norwegian prayer that was an absolute nightmare. We got given this Norwegian prayer. It was in the text, but they'd just written in the script, Norwegian prayer said in Norwegian, but they're written in English. And I said, are we going to get a Norwegian translation? They said, yeah, we're going to have a Norwegian translation. We're going to have stuff. And on the day, thankfully, Jim, who played Icicle's, Jordan's father, is actually Norwegian speaking. Yeah, Sufus. He's Norwegian speaking. And he sat down with me and worked for maybe an hour before we shot, helping me get this very complex tongue twister of a prayer. Nana Flana Likulun. I mean, it sounded like I'm doing a sort of Harry Potter incantation. And that day was stressful because if I'd stopped saying it, it would fall out of my head. It just wouldn't stay in my head. So for the entire day when we'd call cut, I would go off and I would be muttering under my breath, Nana Flana Likulun, or whatever it was, and then checking in with Jim to make sure I got the pronunciation right, because I didn't want any Norwegian speakers to be like, God, he's way off. That's awful. And thankfully, when we did it, we got it. And weirdly enough, 10 minutes after we finally, I said, are we done saying that? And he said, yep, we're moving on from having done the prayer section. 10 minutes later, I couldn't have told you the first line. It just wouldn't stay in my head.
That's amazing. So now, jumping to the end, the mission has been revealed. Jordan has fulfilled the direct vengeance against everyone he holds responsible for his wife's death. And now we're at the very end. He's been foiled. and he drags Barbara up to the top of the clock tower. And you think that he's going to kill her, but he's still trying to convince her that his mission is right and good.
Yeah, that was again another moment of brilliance from Jeff. We would get the episodes, you know, maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks before we shot them. But that episode came in maybe 10 days, I think, before we shot it. And I remember reading it, and I called Jeff up, and I said, I just read the final episode. He said, "What do you think?" I was like, "That rooftop scene. Anyone, you like it?" I was like, "God, thank you. I mean, that's such a gift for an actor to get to play, because the amount of internal emotional conflict that's going on with Jordan at that point is so exciting. I couldn't wait to get my teeth into it, because he is
this woman that he cares for so much."
Yeah.
That even right after Brainwave killed his own son, Jordan's not really willing to hurt her.
Well, this is the thing with Jordan. This is one of the conflicts of Jordan I always found so fascinating and still find fascinating, is the fact that he's not a villain. He has this plan that we've talked about, which is Project New America, which gets revealed. And it's a very noble, altruistic plan. He's going about it in a way that is slightly sinister, and that everybody won't fully agree with his methods. But the reason is 100% understandable and justifiable. He's not just trying to kill people. He's trying to make everything a better place. And in pursuit of this goal of New Project New America, he has set everything aside. He set aside any friendships. He has zero friendships. The closest thing he has to a friend would be Brainwave, which isn't really a friend. It's a colleague. He doesn't really have a close relationship with his son. He tries to foster it, but he's just been away so much and been absent so much because the mission has to take precedence, that he has sacrificed everything. And one of the big things he sacrificed is he hasn't looked anywhere romantically. His wife died. He cut off the romantic part of his emotional brain and drove himself into this mission. And then suddenly Barbara comes along, this ray of sunshine, and he finds himself unwittingly smitten. But he's conflicted because he's also a noble guy. And it sounds weird to say that the villain of the piece is noble, but he's a noble guy. He wouldn't want to break up the family unit. For him, family is everything. That's what Project New America is. It's about families. It's about real, true American values and returning to those wholesome ways. So the last thing he would want to do is be the cause of a disruption within a relationship, and yet he still has these feelings. And so when it comes to Brainwave saying you have to do what's necessary, like I did with my son, Jordan's like, that's not the mission that I set in place. It is, but it's the first time he's wavered. So when it comes to the end and everything's fallen apart and they've foiled his plan, he still needs her to know that he wasn't a villain. He still needs this person that he knows he can't be with, can't ever be with. He still needs to know her to know that the reason he was doing it wasn't because he just wants to see the world burn, kind of like the Joker. He actually is doing it for noble reasons. And if he can just explain it to her, maybe she'll see, and maybe that will be the thing that kind of gives him the hope that he should continue. And of course, he goes about it, as Icicle does, in maybe the wrong way. He drags her to the roof to show her the town and tell her the reasons. But all he does is he makes her scared. He makes her terrified. And sadly, when he makes her terrified, there's a moment in it where he barks at her because she's just not getting it right. And she ends up bringing his wife up, which is his Achilles heel, that sore point. And he barks at her. And he now knows from that moment on, it's irredeemable. She's never going to understand. She's never going to see his side of things. She's always only ever going to see him as the villain. And as a result, she has to go. And when I read that scene, it was exciting for me. And then when I talked to Jeff, it became more exciting. And then when we started rehearsing it and working on it with the director and with Amy, it became even more exciting still, because hopefully what comes across from that is a man who is teetering on the edge, having watched the vision that he's fought so hard for, the sacrifice of all else, collapse around his ears, and he's trying desperately to cling to the last skerrick of hope. He's literally got his pinky finger on the ledge and he's dangling over the abyss. And maybe if she understood, he would be able to get a better hold, but she doesn't. And so he falls, metaphorically. That scene was a joy to play.
It also brings up a good point regarding Brainwave sacrifice. We sort of get the idea that Brainwave does that because he needs to prove himself to Jordan. But now I'm wondering, I don't think Jordan would have asked him to kill his wife or his son.
No, I don't think he would either. I think that's all Brainwave. I mean, if we talked about that, because like I said, I lived with Chris Baker. We had a 2-bedroom apartment in Atlanta that we lived together. We used to call it the Lair. It was actually funny. We got the apartment, and then I went back to London to keep shooting Kingsman. And we'd ordered a load of stuff from IKEA to kind of kit the place out. And I came back, and he'd built the furniture, and he said, "Have a look in your bathroom," because we both had separate bathrooms. I was like, "What do you mean?" And he said, "I'm looking in your bathroom." And I looked in the bathroom and he got me a shower curtain, and the shower curtain was from Frozen. And then I looked in his bathroom, and his shower curtain was a large brain with loads of complex equations all around it. I was like, "That's genius." But me and Chris talked about it. Me and Chris talked about the fact that an argument can be made that the real villain of the piece is Brainwave, because he's the only one that's willing to go to the absolute end to make sure that this thing happens. He killed his wife and he killed his own son. That's about as villainous as you can get.
And there is a hint of a power struggle between the two as well.
Yes, there is. The moment, I mean, there's some great scenes in it. The moment that Brainwave senses weakness within Jordan, he starts to step up to try to position himself as the alpha in the group.
You sense that Jordan is in charge because Brainwave allows it.
Yes.
And if Jordan hadn't made the right decision regarding the Whitmores, Brainwave would have taken him on.
Yes. Yeah, I believe that too. And in an alternate universe, that would be a fascinating battle to see happen as well. Maybe season two we'll get to see that battle happen.
Regarding season two, you get a little bit run over.
Yeah, he kind of falls several stories down onto his face and then gets run over by a truck.
But I don't recall seeing a body.
Yeah, there was no cut to dead icicle. So my hope is that there's a way of bringing him back. Maybe he slinked off into the shadows while he was being forgotten by the Justice Society and they're rejoicing at their victory. He manages to slink himself away and lick his wounds and come back even stronger. That's my hope.
Well, this is comic books. So even if they had a scene of him getting wood chippered Fargo style, there's a way to bring him back.
Yeah, he can just melt those pieces back together and reform himself.
So I don't think things are necessarily over for Mr. Makent or for your job prospects in Atlanta.
It would be very nice after COVID-19 lifts and we can get back to work. It would be very nice to head back to Atlanta or wherever we end up shooting and return to this.
Hopefully it will shoot in Atlanta if we get a second season, because I do not want to miss out on being part of season two if anyone will have me on board.
Well, it would be a pleasure to be working back with you again, mate. And I have framed in my office that wonderful tableau of the Injustice Society that you made up so brilliantly.
I have mine that you gifted me so kindly in my living room, because I have cameras for my other podcast and I don't want to risk getting caught on camera there.
Yeah.
In my studio here.
No, it's smart. It sits there with pride of place. It's got that one that wonderful tableau that you made of the Injustice Society, and just below that, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, signed by Zemeckis. So it's in good company.
Very nice. Neil, thank you so much for being so generous with your time.
My pleasure, Sean.
You've been a fantastic interview.
Lovely chatting to you as always, dude.
Stargirl After Show.
So just a quick wrap up. Sarah, would you like to tell people where they can find your other podcast while they're jonesing for more Stargirl?
Yeah, absolutely. You can check out on the CW app the Nancy Drew first season, and then listen on wherever you listen to podcasts to What's New Nancy Drew, where we do a deep dive into the mystery and try to solve every case that's going on about the new Nancy Drew show. And Sean, where can our listeners find you?
I have another podcast called Table Reads that you can find at tablereadspodcast.com. Me and a couple of friends read bad movie scripts that never got made and mock them for your enjoyment. We are currently going through an aborted 2007 remake, a reboot of Bill and Ted called Bill and Ted's Friggin' Badass Voyage. And it's not terrible. I actually don't despise it. It's a fun read, and it's going along pretty quickly. It's a lot of fun. So that's that. As always, you can find all the Stargirl stuff at stargirlaftershow.com or on our socials, as we said before, at StargirlPod. We'll be back next week with our extended interview with Yvette Monreal. And until then, have a super great day.
Stargirl After Show is a production of Fandom Limb Media.